me pones un hipótesis. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Alia Dastagir, a former U.S. Today reporter whose powerful work on gender and mental health has earned some of journalism's top honors, including the Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism. Her reporting was recognized with a National Headliner Award and the American Association of Suicidology's First Public Service Journalism Award. Alia has been featured on CNN, NPR, and C-SPAN, to name a few. Today, we're talking with Alia about her new book, To Those Who Have Confused You to Be a Person, Words as Violence and Stories of Women's Resilience Online. It's a profound exploration of how language can be used as a weapon and how women are standing up, speaking out, and building resistance in digital spaces. Alia brings incredible heart and insight to a conversation that has been dormant for far too long. Alia, welcome to our show.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me. I loved that introduction. What a great intro, like all that energy, and what an important message on solidarity. I'm just so happy to be here.
Well, the honor is ours, friend. Take us away. Tell us a little bit how you got involved in this work. Tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a simple question, and it always feels so hard to answer because where does the narrative start? Like, where do you begin? But I guess if we're thinking in the context of journalism, I grew up in a family. It's so interesting. I didn't really realize this until people started asking me this. Like, how did you become a journalist? How do you get there? I think we were a family that really respected journalism. And I remember the news was always on, and my mom would talk a lot about Christiane Amanpour. She was a woman journalist that she really respected, and she wasn't even remarking to me, but she was sort of like remarking to herself about what an extraordinary person, woman this was. And I'm sure, I was paying attention. And my dad came to America from Afghanistan when he was a teenager. And I don't remember him saying this to me so much as a young person, but certainly as I got older, I might have even been, I don't know. He used to talk about like professions that he had an enormous amount of respect for. And he would talk about doctors and he would talk about journalists. And so I think I probably also internalize some of that. I think there was, I think that as a lot of kids want to, impress their parents. Like, there was something that they were saying about this profession that I'm sure I internalized, but I also just always did love to write. And I think I was really bad at it for a really long time, but I got so much pleasure from it. It wasn't actually like about being good at it. And then I think, when I graduated undergrad, I went to Binghamton University for undergrad. And I think I was like, okay, I really want to write. I don't want to write fiction. What do I do? I don't know. Journalism just seemed like a good fit. So I became I went to school, grad school at Syracuse for journalism. And I've been a journalist ever since. And I think that my respect for the profession came through my own experiences, right? That I developed that through my own experiences. So even though that message was in the home, I don't think that it was something that I could fully appreciate until I was in a newsroom and was around people who gave so much of themselves and their lives and their just everything, right? To be able to tell people the truth about what's happening in their communities, in their society, right? Like with, you know, their elected officials, right? It's just, it's a job that I've come to respect more and more and more. And I haven't been in a newsroom for a few years because I've been writing this book. But I feel now, you know, there's obviously so many, there are sort of calculated strategic efforts to really undermine the profession, to attack journalists and journalism. And so I feel, while there's much to criticize, right, about, you know, the Fourth Estate, it's still, I feel protective and defensive of that work, because I know how important it is to the health of our democracy.
You know, I love how the great ones always stay humbled. You know, looking at all the great things that you've been able to do with your craft, we are proud, and definitely you inspire us in ways that we believe that our voices are going to be heard. Tell us a little bit about your book. What inspired you to write to those who have confused you to be a person?
Yes.
Such an impactful kind of statement in this book, but tell us a little bit about that. What really got you going to get this down?
Yeah, every time I watch somebody or listen to somebody say the title, I was like, oh, I really got to explain it, because it is, it's you know, it's a lot. And so I guess I'll start, so I want to talk about that, but I'll start a little bit before that. So I was a reporter at USA Today for about 10 years. And around 2016, 2017, sort of during the first Trump presidency, I started to experience online abuse in my role as a reporter in that newsroom. And I think that, and there were sort of a lot of things kind of going on at the time, and also my role in the newsroom changed at that time. I started to cover, I was an editor when I first came in, and then I moved to be a reporter, and I was covering gender, race, the intersection of identity and politics, and doing that sort of, you know, sort of looking at what feminism would look like under a Trump presidency, sort of, I think maybe it did make me a target. And so my abuse sort of ramped up 2016, 2017. And I think in the beginning, I was kind of, speaking of internalizing things, I think I internalized the attitude, the message, the idea, the notion that in order to do my job, I was going to have to ignore this. I was going to have to let some amount of it kind of roll off my back. I was going to have to figure out a way to deal with it, because it became sort of a feature of the job. And then in 2019, I had had my, I had a baby. I had my second baby, and I was breastfeeding her. I was in at her room, I was feeding her, and I looked at my phone, because, you know, you just, when you're breastfeeding, you kind of get stuck and you don't know how long you're going to be somewhere. And you're just like, man, I gotta see what's going on here. So I took my phone out, and I was, I saw that I had a message from somebody on Facebook who had read a story that I wrote, ironically, about online abuse of women journalists, and was very upset about it, because of the news event that story had been pegged to. It was about it had been pegged to the death of Kobe Bryant. So this was like a very, you know, this is an emotional, right? Like sort of collectively, like a very emotional moment. And so this reader messaged me, and he said, I'm sorry to those who have confused you to be a person, because you are not a person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was what he said in sort of in response to what he perceived to be a story that I wrote that I think he believed really sort of dehumanized Kobe Bryant, right? Like was not showing humanity to this person. And so anyway, there was a lot kind of going on there in that message, but I remember very distinctly two things. One, feeling so much dissonance between what this person was saying to me and what was kind of happening in that room. So I'm in the room with a life that I helped create. I helped like make this life, and I was nourishing this life. You know, I was keeping this baby alive, basically with my life, with my body. And this person was telling me that I did not, you know, belong in the human community, that this person did not see me as a human being. And I think there was a lot of dissonance there. And I remember just so distinctly, and I think I probably wrote it down, because I thought, oh my God, we, you know, for all that we talk about with this issue of online abuse, we really, I don't know that we grasp what that feels like, the texture of your life, like during these experiences. But really what happened was I got mad. I don't know why that moment, maybe it just felt like such an intrusion, and I got so mad, and I resolved kind of in that moment. I was like, okay, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to turn this into something. I didn't know exactly what it would look like, what form it would take. I did want to write a book, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't know the shape of it, but I felt a ton of resolve in that moment, because I felt like I had something to say. And I also felt so mad that this person was doing, not just this person, that so many people had been doing this. And I wanted to figure out how to a way to sort of take this thing that was so so difficult and wrong and malicious, and kind of turn it into something else that could be good and useful and productive. So that's kind of, you know, that's sort of the origin story of the project. And of course it evolved to be what it is now, which is not just my story, but the story of many other women who've had these experiences.
It's incredible to see how your life and mine are kind of parallel in that way. When I created this platform, I have shared before that I was at a retreat and I'm just enjoying myself. We're stretching out, meeting new people. And someone made a comment. Back then I was a school social worker, and this higher up made the comment and says, he's just a social worker to the other person. And what I did was the same as you. I got mad. I got even. And here we are, close to 100 podcast radio show kicking. And this is what we have to do when we have to fight back. This is why I am proud to tell your story here. And there's no shame. What I found interesting was your storytelling early on, even in this intro, when you got in, you're like looking around, spacing if your daughter is safe. Can she understand what this man just wrote? Am I aware of my own awareness? There was so much that you uncovered early. I was like, she is so dope. And I just said to myself,
yes,
I have to find a way to channel when we get into this anger. And because you work so much with mental health, Many people do believe that getting angry is not a good thing, but you again have now demonstrated that when we channel this anger, we can do something for the greater good. So you have showed us that, and now you're telling us that. Tell us a little bit about this. Now you're still angry because sometimes we're riding on this fume that we're mad and we got this energy going. What were some of the challenges for you in writing this book now that you ran into this? Like, am I really writing a book?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the anger piece, it's really interesting. Like, so the initial impulse that came out of that anger, it did animate me. And that was great. I was animated to write a book. But I did need to sort of move also into different states of mind to be able to... And I don't want to like suggest that anger is sort of illogical or like an irrational place to be, but I did have to move to other states of mind and being in order to think most strategically about what this book should look like so that it could actually be the most effective. So I think in terms of the challenges for me is, you know, I had such a narrow and sort of myopic view of the problem initially, because one, I had come to the problem of online abuse, online violence. I'd come to it late, in that, you know, like so many things, there were so many women who had been talking about this for many, many years, particularly women of color who had been really lobbying the platforms, you know, sort of working together to gather sort of intel and information about the ways that these platforms were abusive, these social media platforms were abusive, and the way that they were able to be weaponized, right, to like spread disinformation, misinformation. So I was so late. There were so many people, like certainly early adopters, and of course, you know, a lot of these Black, very savvy Black digital feminists who've been talking about this for a long time. And I also initially was just, I was so deep in my own experience. I was just, I only knew what I knew and what I felt. And so the challenge was to move outside of that, to really consider and to look to the past and to look around. I could even just look laterally at the women of color who were in my newsroom and just sort of see what they were sort of were dealing with, right? Which is not just being called a slur, but being called a house slave, right? So the abuse was textured so differently. So I had to get outside of myself, and I had to really, and it was a really, and I still feel regretful that I didn't capture as many experiences as I would have liked to, but I really did try to capture a diversity of experiences, because while the online abuse can look sort of the same, like it shares similar features, our experiences are influenced by the deep and rich variability of our lives, our race, our, you know, our resources, our age, our class, our immigrant status, right? Like all these things, our disability status. So I think, you know, it was the earliest challenge was just to get outside of myself and to really listen and to pay close attention and to be humbled also by the anger that, you know, I was being expressed by the women that I was interviewing, right? Like some of them were angry because no one had paid attention, and some women were angry that I was paying attention, but was still asking the wrong questions, right? And that's totally legitimate. So yeah, that was the biggest sort of early kind of challenge. But I think the anger was useful for me. And I think it was telling, right? To hear so much anger from the women that I interviewed. They were most comfortable, many of them were more comfortable expressing anger than they were expressing hurt, because being publicly vulnerable around this issue can make you, and it, you know, can get targeted for that vulnerability on top of whatever you were being targeted for.
You know, you bring in so many great points. And when I listen to you, I get to listen to the words and they just become and appear, right? And I'm able to look at these words and I keep hearing the word violent and violence, right? And when you're talking about being used, when words are being used in the method of violence, What are those things for you, and what do you think those mean on a human level? Someone standing behind some sort of dashboard or computer or whatever they use to say all these terrible things about people or towards them and use those words in a violent way. What do you think that means?
I mean, I think, you know, when I think that one of the challenges that I knew that I would have early on, both because I like believed that I would, and also people who I really respect told me that I would, was sort of making the case that this was violent. You know, there are really excellent, smart, you know, sort of arguments, right, around whether, you know, around what it means, right? What are the consequences, right, of claiming that language can be violent? And so I sort of went into the project with that idea in my mind, and this didn't make it into the book, but I think that the reason, and I hope I'm answering your question, but I think that the reason that I felt comfortable ultimately calling this violence, this being the experience of being a woman or a marginalized person in these online spaces, it's because I asked, like, I think I asked almost every woman that I ended up profiling. So every chapter profiles a woman. And then there's other stories sort of woven through, but there's one sort of central story. And I'm pretty sure that every single woman, I think I asked her, how would you define violence? And I didn't, it was a question that was, I think, maybe frustrated some people, because they're like, come on, like, why are you asking? I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a, but other, you know, so some people I think were really taken aback by it, maybe a little frustrated by it, but others were, it was very reflexive. But the key thing was that almost every single person that I asked that question of responded that they believed that violence was harm, was harm. And, you know, that's obviously that can be so many things, and harm can be self-defined, right? Like what I say is harmful, you know, to me is not necessarily going to be what another woman is going to say is harmful to her. And so it was very important to me to make sure that this book stressed in this project that when we're talking about violence, we're talking about harm. That harm can be psychological, it can be physiological, you know, these experiences can lead to chronic stress, right? It can be reputational, you know, it can be economic, lost job opportunities, all these things. So whatever the antagonist, so I think that some of our antagonists are incredibly strategic, right? Like some people know exactly what they're trying to do to us, right? And other people, you know, might be doing these things because they can, right? They can get away with it. But I think that it's, you know, one of the things that I just really hope people kind of take away from the project if they do pick up the book is that no one deserves to be harmed, right? Like you know, we I believe, and I, you know, believe many of the women I interview believe that we all deserve to live lives free of all forms of violence. And what society or what another person might say is, yeah, like my claim is harmful. You just, there's some part of this that you need, that I felt like it was important that women have the autonomy to say, this harmed me, even if it doesn't fit a popular definition of what online harassment or online abuse is. That was really important.
I think you got that established early on, and just we'll deep in to what some of your interviews look like. But looking at this from this stance, violence sometimes doesn't always come in the physical. And you named the psychological effects. These psychological ones take way more time, because if you got harassed in a way that was detrimental to anything, whether it is your real life, your career, something about you that could dename you in any way, that psychological effect to me lasts longer. And those are tougher to overcome because now it becomes traumatic and it's hard for you to kind of be able to answer the way you would, understanding that you're worried and concerned that you now lose some of that voice, some of that autonomy that you were like talking about. How do you see language kind of shaping the woman experience on the line of the online world, if you will? Like, what are things that after you got this book out, you believe can be changed when they read your book about how women see the experience when they're being harassed and probably did not know it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I really appreciate this question on language, because I think that it's hard to talk about this issue. Like we all can feel so, it's not difficult to feel cynical. You know, it's, you know, you really do, everything feels really bad. And honestly, like, this is just one sort of part of a broken internet, right? Like, there's so many things that feel so toxic and so wrong and so difficult about these spaces. There's times where I'm here where I'm just feeling almost like, it's unusable to me in many ways. But I think that on the language piece, what I really wanted this project to do was to give women a richer, deeper, more sort of expansive vocabulary for what is happening to them. Because I think, you know, you can have these experiences and you can try very hard to dismiss them or compartmentalize them or do all the things that the culture sort of suggests you should, that you have to do, right, in order to be able to participate in these spaces. Or you can feel really terrible and sort of let yourself feel really terrible, but you don't always know why, because this is another quote that didn't make it into the book, because this is what always happens when you over report. But there was a woman that I gotta try to remember what she said. There was a woman who said something to me. She's a scholar that I really respect, and she said something along the lines of, you know, it can be really hard as like a woman in 2025 to have these experiences and to and to be upset by them. Like you feel like you should be able to sort of intellectualize around them, especially if you are like a person who's very aware of, okay, this is happening, or maybe you identify as a feminist woman, or maybe you identify as just a strong woman. I don't know. What there are so many ways that you you can tell yourself and about why it shouldn't bother you, but then it does anyway, right? So I wanted to be able to address some of that here too, to just be like, okay, all of those things that you're feeling, or many of those things that you're feeling, many of those experiences that are happening at a physiological level too, this is not only, you know, not only is this expected, this is normal. This is what it means to be human. This is what it means to be alive. Like, you're not supposed to just ignore people threatening you, rejecting you, excluding you, categorizing you, right, in these really malicious ways. Like, you're not built to ignore that. You're built to take that information in and help, you know, and then process it to make really good decisions, right? To try to keep yourself sort of safe and alive. So I really wanted to be able to have, yeah, like a deeper vocabulary and a deeper kind of understanding of what the pain is and where it kind of comes from, even at like sort of a biological level, and that it's not their fault. Because I think that sometimes with these experiences, like I still do this. Every time I get an abusive message, the first thing I say to myself is, what did I do? Every time, even for all these years, you know, all these things, it's the first. So it's just helpful to, you know, constantly remind people that it's part of a larger story, right? I hope that answers some of your questions.
And it does. And I like how you kind of frame and let me understand there are sometimes people who just say sorry way too much. And that sounded to me like that even though, oh my God, what do I got to do to kind of shed this off me? Like, what? Why do I keep doing this wrong? And it's not really about that. Talk to me about these superheroes that you went out here and got together with to make this book, you know, such a masterpiece as it is, because is there stories, is there worlds that you kind of were able to tap into aside from your own? Yes. What was so special about that? And can you walk us through that process of how you got to pick the women and decided on who to put in there?
Yeah, for sure. So grateful to these women. I feel like a little bit protective of them too, because like I, you know, we were sort of discussing earlier, we were talking about anger and sort of hurt. Like it's so bad just to experience it in the first place, to experience this harassment, this abuse, this violence, this hate. And then if you dare to sort of speak publicly about it, it's used against you, right? You're called mm-hmm. fragile, or you're mm-hmm. whining, or you're weak, or like, you know, why can't, you know, you just suck it up. It's the internet, you know, whatever. Everybody's dealing with this, which I think is absurd on so many levels, and we can talk about that. But I mean, I feel really grateful because that is a risk, right? It is a risk to talk about it. You risk further abuse. And so I came to my sources. I found my sources in a number of different ways. Some were people that I had interviewed for stories at USA Today, and I, you know, made some correct assumptions about what I thought that they might be dealing with based on the work that they did. So there were some sociologists that I knew through my work at USA Today. I would do, you know, just asking those people, who do you know in your world? On social media, you know, just obviously paying attention there. And again, if somebody was able to, you know, was willing to sort of post about their abuse there, that was a great sign that that was something that they were comfortable sort of talking about. And so that's how I found the feminist comedian in chapter two. She had posted about her abuse, and then I reached out to her. She wanted to talk. Some were colleagues. Nancy Armour, USA Today sports columnist, was a former colleague. And then there were a number of women that I just had my eye on for a while for a few reasons. One is because, you know, they might have been dealing with something that felt like it helped sort of complicate the issue, right? We're not just talking about, you know, white guys in the manosphere, anti-feminist, you know, men, right, coming after women. There's so much that's kind of going on here, right? Like Lindsay Boylan, who was the first woman to accuse former Governor Andrew Cuomo of sexual harassment publicly. I mean, she was abused online, there was reporting, excellent reporting done from the New York Times that showed that it was women that had banded together online to try to retaliate against her and defame her and, you know, kind of shut her down. But I also had my eye on people. So I had my eye on people because I was like, this is a different flavor of this. And this is also, you know, worth sort of attending to, especially because this also keeps women down, right? Like, this is another piece of it. But also because the process of writing a book and bringing any kind of intellectual project, you know, I don't know what you sort of went through just to kind of bring your, you know, podcast to life, right? But there's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of setbacks. It's hard to bring a project, a passion project to life. And I faced a lot of rejection early on with this book and just trying to sell the book. And then there would be some women who just continued to like beat the drum on this and like why it was important. So even when I would have moments where I was like, okay, I give up. Like, I'm not going to do this. I can't sell this. Nobody cares. People are exhausted by this topic. People are resigned. People think it's inevitable. It's unsolvable. Nobody cares. Then I would see somebody like, for example, Taylor Lorenz, who's a technology journalist, and now she's independent. She's got this excellent newsletter called User Mag, and she's got a podcast. But she was at the Times, and she was at the Washington Post, and she at some point when I was early on in these kind of rejections, she posted something. She said, "Online abuse has ruined my life. It destroyed my life. It has destroyed my life." Mm. And in response, all these hosts on conservative media just, you know, started to assail her, mock her, turn all her pain, you know, into more content, right? So I found them through a variety of, you know, there were lots of ways, right, that I came to my sources, and I remain grateful to all of them because even, you know, some of them honestly kept the project alive when I felt like it wasn't going to see the light of day.
Mm, and big up to them, wherever they are listening and just being superheroes as they should be. For me, I can't, you know, stop thinking about the many ways that you still have to conquer. I can see you providing talks for younger teens, for people who are just becoming involved in social media. There is so much to worry about. And I know that internet safety is one of them, but you named something that really typically happens within our schools. As a school leader myself, I can tell you that a lot of the worries that I also have is remember not to press send, because once you press send, you can't unsend it, right? And those memories and that backlash stays. And you name some powerful names of women who have had to endure. And the list is longer than we can probably name during this hour. But I can tell you that it takes a lot of courage to be able to do this. So again, big up to you and to the women that kind of allowed the project to kind of flow. Is there one story that really stuck out for you and you said, I'm going to put it in this order versus that one? Mm. Or does that matter to you in any way?
So interesting because, so the format of the book is, as I said, each chapter sort of opens with a woman's story and then kind of uses her story to open up different kinds of questions, bigger questions, about what that story sort of says about, I don't know, something sociological or psychological or technological or about this moment or about democracy. It's, you know, very narrow, and then we get kind of bigger. It's narrow and then we get kind of bigger. And then we narrow again at the end of each chapter to talk about a specific way that that woman coped with her abuse. And it's interesting because I you know, I had to kind of organize. There were lots of things on my mind as I was organizing the stories. We talked a little bit earlier about how I felt very late to the issue. And I also felt like this is an issue, you know, just seeing the way these platforms really responded or failed to respond to so many of the Black women who we're talking about this again before this issue really got mainstream. And even now, you know, it became clear that this issue wasn't just about misogyny. This is also about white supremacy, right? So in that way, I knew chapter one, I was going to follow a Black woman. I was going to follow a Black woman who was trying to navigate sort of a predominantly white space and, you know, talk about kind of, you know, what her experience was like. So that was a non-negotiable. We were going to set that. I didn't feel like we could tell any other story until we made it very clear that this is about so much more than misogyny. It's about white supremacy and all the systems that sort of intertwine with that. And then the later kind of organization was really based on storytelling. Like, how do we keep the reader, and what ideas do we need to establish before we can build to the next idea? So in some ways, the coping is sort of like that part is sort of ancillary, because everybody, I focus on each woman's coping strategy that I felt was emblematic of that story. But every person, nobody's just using one strategy to cope ever, right? We're always using many strategies simultaneously. Some we're conscious of, some we're not. But to answer your original question of which one has stayed with me, I mentioned feminist comedian, her name is Maria Dakota. She's in chapter two. And I have thought about her a lot in the last few months. And I was trying to think about why she has kind of been at the front of my mind. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One is that it was really interesting because she's a comedian. And when we got on the phone, I think I assumed that it would be like, we would laugh. Like, it would be like, she would make jokes and I would make jokes. I do use humor to cope with a lot of difficulty. And so I was expecting that conversation to feel a certain way. And when we got on the phone, she was the most, there was no laughing. I mean, there was no laughing. It was not funny. There was no levity. She was so, distraught about, you know, what she had been experiencing. I reached her, I think, at a moment where she was also just so ready to talk about not just how angry she was, how hurt she was. She was the interview that was, she was the most willing, I think, to say even just like the word hurt. So that has stayed with me. But I think also she said something at one point, she had a quote where she was talking about her online abusers, like about these antagonists and kind of like what they want, like what they want when they abuse her. And she was saying she said something like, they want us to disappear, and they want us, you know, they want it, you know, like something about disappearing. And that has been on my mind, because we are also in a moment right now, sort of politically, where people are just disappearing. Mm-hmm. People are disappearing. Like people, you know, people are being deported. People are being, we don't know where people are. You know, there are, you know, changes within this current administration that are sort of limiting the kinds of words that we can use in government documents. And, you know, some of those words are, you know, women and woman and trauma and, mm-hmm. and things like that. So I think that notion of disappearing, I think I could hear her when she said that, but I really couldn't feel it until this moment, maybe in some ways. And so that her story has very much been on my mind.
I'm glad you told her story and all the others, because I want people to be reminded that when you hear women, don't think about weakness or people giving up. Think about power and strength, and think about how you guys continue to push. No matter what we are hearing, listening to, people are talking about, women continue to impress with the very best. Let me just say that on top of that, what is something that people can get from your book that probably they don't know about online abuse, that once they get your book, they say, wow, I didn't even know that. Thank you for sharing that. Is there some of those nuggets you can do with that?
I can only place myself in the position of, like, I guess I can think back to my reporting on the things that felt like big moments for me. I was like, oh, I didn't know that. That's obvious and also crazy. I guess two things maybe that I think about. And I don't think that they are you know, I have some self-consciousness with this project because I do feel like sometimes there are moments when I feel like I'm stating the obvious, but I also think that you can lose sight of what is obvious because things are difficult, because life is very hard and you're trying to survive in this day-to-day, moment-to-moment, minute-to-minute way, and you can sometimes forget these things. So, I mean, I think that, you know, the sort of biological reality, again, you know, that when we, I'm not saying everybody feels this or everybody thinks this or everyone claims this, but I do think there is a general attitude of, if you're going to be online, you have to ignore some level of abuse, right? You have to be able to ignore this. And I think sometimes when we say ignore, we mean don't react. And sometimes when we say ignore, we mean don't feel. And I think that latter part is really the problem. And I think, you know, if you pick up this book, or, you know, you're gonna, or when you pick up this book, you're going to read about all of the science that tells you why that is so, like, why that is such an absurd and ridiculous notion, right? Because our emotion, we are built with emotions. Like, we have emotions for a reason, and our emotions are physical experiences, right? Like, this is, we are not built to ignore language, right? Language is how we connect and create bonds, and language is how we, again, right, like, reject people, attack people, threaten people, right? So we're not built to ignore that. Mm-hmm. We're built to believe that the things that people are saying to us matter. And if they don't matter, you know, we have to do some cognitive work. It might be really fast, right? You might be really good at it. You might deal with this all the time, and it becomes almost kind of reflective. But you have to do some cognitive work to sort of get yourself off your back foot and be like, oh, that thing that that person is saying to me, it doesn't align with how I see myself. It's not, I don't have to listen to that. That's just work, right? So there's all of this, you know, very important science that, you know, the power of words is not a metaphor. The parts of your brain that process language are the same parts of your brain that, you know, control major body systems, right? Adjusting glucose, managing your immune system, your heart rate, all that stuff. So I think that, and I do try to bring this point back, you know, try to hit this over and over and over again in different ways, or come to it in different ways, which is to say that every single thing that you experience as a result of this abuse or this harassment or this hate, it is normal. It is human. It is your body trying to do exactly what it was built to do. Mm-hmm. And then I think the only other thing that I think maybe, you know, kind of, again, I don't know why it surprised me, but I think it was just having somebody say it that I was like, oh man, you know, I interviewed a neuroscientist, I interviewed a neuroscientist for the book. I cited others, but, and she told me that the human brain hasn't adapted to the internet, right? Like, we haven't evolved to this idea that, well, we'll just, like, somehow eventually just evolve, right? And we'll be able to tell ourselves that's just the internet and this is something else and this person is not gonna hurt me or whatever, right? That is actually never gonna happen, right? Because human beings have evolved so slowly, and technology has evolved in the blink of an eye, and it is continuing to evolve, right? Like, we're talking at a time where we are now in the age of AI, right? Mm-hmm. So I asked this woman, not a neuroscientist, this other woman who studies aggression online. I was like, okay, could we ever evolve? And she was like, the earth will have gone spinning into the sun. Like, we're never going to catch up. Mm-hmm. So this idea that human beings will somehow be able to just totally intellectualize around this stuff, it's just a fallacy. And I think that's really important for people to know.
You know, in listening to you in this evolvement, shifting here a bit, let's go into texting, where online seems to be the theme, but you can tell in relationships that people use text. You go on and probably write a long paragraph and someone says, good, okay. Like, do they care about what I just said? Or you're getting caught up into a situation where people understand your behavior, as you mentioned AI, but even person to person, friend to friend in relationships, people hide behind technology, and they had this texting courage where they could stand behind something and say all kind of things. But if you see them face to face, they're not even half of what they claim to be. The one thing that I found, again, that was powerful was how you centered women's resistance, right? And you name some of it, how they kind of started out in shells, if you will. But then it was important for you to show the harm, the process. And then you also wanted to name at the end the coping, the fight back. So I think that that was important as well, because no matter the way of the technology and how it arrives, I thought that your book also named the ability to show that this was something that was hurtful, that was difficult, but yet it was important for you to show the fight back. Mm-hmm. Can you help us understand resistance, you know, in a way that this is a world that violence is really invisible? How can we kind of name it and be able to say to ourselves, these are steps that I need to take to fight back if I see any of these signs?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, I'm glad that you find value in the coping, because I think that's like the part of the book that I was most kind of self-conscious of. I was always really good at, like, I have a history of naming problems, right? Solving them is a whole other, you know, thing. So the coping part of the book was where I felt most kind of, I had a lot of trepidation there. I didn't want to write a prescriptive book. I didn't want to say, here's what you should do, because I think that, you know, part of what was became really clear to me very early on in the reporting was, I mean, not only do we all have sort of different resources and skills and resiliencies and all those different things, right? There's a really big difference between being a journalist at a national news organization dealing with this, right? And like being able to go to an editor, having a legal team, or, you know, whatever it is, and being an independent journalist or being an independent, you know, disinformation researcher, or, you know, whatever it may be. So I think we have all these different kinds of, you know, we have these different sort of profiles, right? But I also think that we all have different goals. So that's the thing, right? Like I think generally most of the women that I interviewed do have the goal of sort of fighting the oppressor. But many women who read the book might not share that goal, right? And so different goals require, you know, sort of different strategies, right? They might, right? So if your goal is to fight the oppressor, like maybe you really need to kind of be, like we were talking about anger, like to really be in your anger and channel your anger and let that, you know, anger really animate you and move you. And maybe if your goal is just to, you know, sort of psychologically preserve yourself, right, in a moment, because you just can't take it anymore for that day or that whatever. Maybe you're just in a moment in your life where you just cannot, or you need to go to work, or you need to take care of your kids, you need to do something and you just can't. So the goal of psychologically preserving yourself might mean being in a different kind of emotional state, right? Like maybe you're gonna think about this thing that upset you and try to reframe it, right? And try to reappraise it and try to think about it differently so that it upsets you less. And that is interesting, because then it becomes kind of dangerous, because the story that you tell yourself to make it upset you less might not be true. And so that can be a difficulty, right? Like maybe somebody sexually harasses you and then you sort of convince yourself, okay, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal, right? Because you need to psychologically preserve yourself. It might still have been that, but you can do also, there's all sorts of cognitive tricks you can play. So I think it's important to just sort of note that, like, every person is different. Everybody has different goals and all these different strategies, or, you know, we're going to be, they are sort of, right, sometimes kind of goal dependent. But I wrote the last chapter. That's why I was so happy when you opened this podcast talking about solidarity, or, you know, opened the show talking about solidarity and resistance, because, you know, this last chapter is so focused on that. And that's where, again, I sort of get subconscious, because, you know, you do feel like you're stating the obvious, but human beings are not meant to survive alone. Like, we're not meant to cope alone. Like, we deserve community. We need community. And so, you know, the one thing that I think every woman said was most kind of helpful to her, you know, sort of reliably helpful to her, was just having other people she could talk to, other people she could, you know, whether it's the friend who always picks up the phone or the colleague who just gets it or the group text, you know, back, you know, texting isn't all bad, right? So the group text, like, are those people who just your girl gang, you know, whatever it is, those people who truly get it, or even if they don't get it, aren't going to dismiss you, aren't going to have this dismissive reflexive reaction that's like, well, just knock off, or like, what did you expect? Or all these things that really kind of start to sound almost like victim blaming, right? Like, why don't you just do this thing and like get off the internet? You know, it's just like, because I belong here and I should be able to be here, right? So it's not, don't make it about that. But I think that the point is that notion of social support, which is so evidence-based and like, is so helpful, right? Just like in you know, getting, you know, giving us better outcomes, right? When we are sort of suffering, it connects to that larger idea of resistance and solidarity. You need to be able to, you need other people, right? To be part of that sort of larger transformational kind of struggle. And so I think it was really important to be able to end the project, to end the book, to end it with that idea that we don't survive alone. We don't cope and make meaning alone.
You know, you wrote so many stories that were so intimate in different ways and special. Was there a story or is there a story that really drew you from your emotional side that was very difficult for you to kind of deal with? And I know we talked about what surprised you earlier about
Chapter 2,
but what was a story that really drew you emotionally? And tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, what a good question. Nobody's asked me that yet. Okay, I gotta be honest. I had to compartmentalize to do this. I wasn't really feeling, I really had to, like, I'm in my, I can only answer honestly. I'm sure this is gonna sound, well, I don't know. Who cares how it sounds? It's true. So I really had to compartmentalize to do, and this is true, you know, in journalism broadly, right? Like, people are telling you, like, you know, the worst things that have ever happened to them. Sometimes you're interviewing them immediately after the worst things that have ever happened to them. And so I do think that I've practiced in sort of having a healthy kind of distance, like keeping a kind of healthy distance, right? Like when I'm doing that kind of reporting, certainly when I finished the book and I read it like all together to myself. I mean, I read it, God, I don't even know, like 500 times, but I would read it. Every time I read it, I still got emotional when I saw the whole thing and I saw all of us together in that way. But honestly, the thing that was hardest, the thing that made me the most, I don't even want to say emotional, but the thing that got me the most kind of activated was when I had to revisit my own traumatic experiences of online abuse and write about them. So I had a number of different experiences, but the worst was when I was targeted by an online mob. That happened in 2022. And when I would read the whole book when I was, you know, going through the editing and, you know, just, I would always leave that section. I like didn't want to touch it. It's a section that comes, that I talk about in most detail in the final chapter, and it's called The Mob. And I even as I'm talking to you, I just could not stand rehashing that. I don't want to go so far as to say re-traumatizing, but I would have a physical reaction every single time, you know, because that was a story where I really felt like outrage was weaponized against me and my words were manipulated and everything was distorted. So even when I was writing here and I was trying to be so precise and so accurate and truthful and all the things, I was just like, I think I had in my mind this idea that no matter what I do or what I say or what I write, like, this is going to get manipulated and distorted again. And there was something that felt very violating about that. So I think that, yeah, honestly, it was going back into my own history of drama around this. Like, that was an incredibly traumatic experience. And it was very difficult to write about it.
Thank you so much for sharing that, friend. And I'm sorry to bring that back up, but I think that it needs to be heard so that we can make change, and change needs to happen. Before we let you go, the floor is yours, my friend. Let's remind everyone, all our listeners, what to look out for you. What is the movement? Where is it going? Take us away.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to leave you with just a single idea, because there's so many things that obviously need to happen. And again, to be frank, like, there are people who've been working on this issue for just so much longer than I have even been experiencing the problem. And their work is out there, and they're sort of very deep in the tech and what needs to happen and how online misogyny is really shifting and evolving, right? It's not just words, right? It's deep fake, it's image based, there's a lot kind of happening here, and there's a lot that needs to happen to respond in meaningful ways, policy, you know, legislative action on civil rights and privacy. There needs to be real sort of consequences for people who sort of engage in this bad behavior, better training for everybody, institutions, journalists. But I think that the idea that I want to leave you with, you know, because I don't know that this is, I don't know, like, where a movement is can be so diffuse, right? I think the idea, the notion that I want to leave people with is that, I guess I just want people to fight that resignation and that sense of inevitability, because it might seem trite to say, I know how it can sound trite, but I still think it's important for us to remember to be really shocked by things and to be disgusted by this, and to not, you know, to not just resign ourselves to living like this and to having these spaces be so toxic. I mean, these are technologies that human beings created. Language is what we created, and we created the boundaries around both of these things. So while it might be incredibly difficult to imagine and actually execute, it's also true to say that, you know, we can draw new boundaries, right, around both of these things. And so I just really hope that people will recognize their very real human responses to harm, have them, you know, maybe validated through this project, but also to remind themselves that even though it's very easy to descend into cynicism and despair, there are still things much to be hopeful about.
Hopeful. Yes. Hopeful we are. Friends, meet your goals today by deflating stressors, increasing your forward thinking, and always understanding your worth. You should not feel or be judged for aiming for more autonomy on your path towards greatness. Stay on your course, because haters, they gonna keep hating. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out.
Thanks for having me.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you, more than just, at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.